So I heard from my cousin this week. My cousin's actually a programmer, trains programmers. And he's got a big job with the Navy, training programmers for the Navy. But he got fired, unfortunately. He really couldn't figure out how to make a subclass. Hey, guys. Daniel Markham here with Nerd Roundup. If Nerd Roundup is basically tech news of the week shared by programmers. And we try to have fun and just goof off as much as possible. I think you can learn a lot more and do a lot more when you can relax with people of various viewpoints and just kind of shoot the shit. So belly up to the lunch table and we'll go with the roundup. Today we have Greg Young and James Grinning. James.
Hey there, Dan.
Howdy. Greg, I think, is on audio. Greg, you there?
No, I'm invisible.
Oh, wow, you're like a virtual Greg. So you're like...
I am actually an artificial simulation of Greg.
Well, we have the Greg audio interface, but we don't have the instantiation of the Greg object. I don't think we have the complete Greg here. it's an RPC, right? So, guys, what have you been up... Greg, what have you been up to this week?
All sorts of interesting things. Like bizarre problems getting into, and I've worked a bit more on a couple chess problems. Ooh. Which have been fun. I mean, you never want to talk about like all the boring stuff. Like, yeah, I managed to put some rows in a database. Wow.
Yeah, you got to learn this consulting stuff. What have you been doing? Well, I saved the earth for a couple times, and then there was world hunger, so all that. James? What have we been doing this week? Doing any more training stuff?
Putting some rows in a database for me would be an awesome thing, but because I don't get to do it all the time. But good to be with you, nerds.
You've been doing a Docker. Have you finished up your Docker project with your website?
Docker project.
Yeah. You were talking about setting up a.
Working on a number of things, and there's been a lot of family coming to visit us. So we've had a lot of good distractions, little ones and big ones, and. So I've been working on my videos. I've got those about ready. I'm going to try a pilot class out with one client for the self-paced TDD training class I've been working on for a long time.
Very cool.
And as my also my IT department, I've been doing some stuff to my website. Actually, I'm kind of worried about not being able to recreate it, so I've been spending a lot of effort to make sure that I can build it from scratch in Docker, and now I've managed that secret sauce.
Ooh. Very cool.
I did have one interesting thing that I was doing. I was trying to explain to an astrophysicist why you want to run cat data, pipe to grep, pipe to processing, as opposed to cat data, pipe to processing, pipe to grep.
Oh my God. That's it hurts me to hear that. Okay, we're gonna be doing some Unix stuff today. As a matter of fact,
it was literally an order of magnitude speed up.
Yeah, oh for sure. Yeah, you're it's like same thing with select queries. You try to get that narrowed down as quick as possible.
I think that would make the processing easier too, because you could get rid of all the stuff you don't care about.
Yes,
so you'd have to weed through. Right. Otherwise.
By the way, what I was pointing out was when you're doing SQL in a database and you've got a huge thing, do the thing to narrow it down first, just like Greg's talking, and then you do whatever other conditions you have, because you don't want a big fire hose full of data coming down to your system. So what I have been doing, last week after Nerd Roundup, I thought, you know, I'm going to take this script I used to make random slideshows, I'm going to make a script to make a random music video. You just take a folder, drop some MP3s in it, drop some pictures in it, run the script. It make bada boom, bada bing. It makes a random music shuffle with random slides. And I got it working. And then I erased all the code in the folder, including the script itself. And I said some words I should not say, and I know better. I know, you know, if only I had some tool that would keep track of things that I changed, and I could roll.
If this makes you feel any better, Dan, it'll be easier the second time.
I had to walk away. I didn't get back on the computer for a day. You're supposed to like vision a successful thing, and I have had this vision of me and my shotgun shooting the computer. And so until that went away, I didn't come back to the computer. Oh my God, that was awful. And I'm not, the thing is, I know better. What happened was I had little chunks of scripts, maybe 5-6 lines of code, which all worked fine. And all I wanted to do is make 5 or 6 of these, put them all together in one script and run them. And there was only one chunk that was whack, and it was the one that erased the current directory. They all worked fine. And when I tested that one script, it was inside the directory I wanted to erase. So, right.
I've been trying to convert you to run VMS for quite some time.
Yes.
And I will just tell you that if you were running VMS, you would have had a semicolon numbered version of the file, and you wouldn't have had a problem.
The XFS file system.
VMS? Is VMS still a thing?
Yeah, of course it is.
Serious question.
Well, I it is, I believe. I don't know if it runs in production or not.
I guess CPM's a thing still.
Oh my God, for sure, yeah.
Is that a reason to get
people doing VSAM, yeah. And Kix and all that stuff still, there are people out there doing. I wouldn't use it, but it's being done for sure.
All right.
So I did that, and then yesterday, I finished up reading this book on the French Revolution, and I was thinking about that book and a bunch of other books and such, and I thought, you know, there's actually something here about order change that people miss, and the fact is that organizations are complex systems, and even though we all can all agree that we want people to be free and empowered and goodness around apple pie motherhood, when you have an existing system and you're trying to move it, whatever you do has, you know, non-predictable impacts on everything else, and it becomes really, you can't predict what's going to happen. So you have to take sort of a profound ignorance standpoint and just do a little experimentation in isolation instead of just thinking, hey, we're just all going to be happy and sing songs and believe that's all going to work out well, because it never works out well.
That might be the best explanation of Six Sigma I've ever heard.
Yeah, It applied, because people keep asking, why was the American Revolution successful when all of these other revolutions were bloody, just horrible things? And the answer was, we didn't have anything. We just kind of started from zero, and we weren't interfered with, and we just sort of created it all ad hoc and tried to do the minimum amount possible. Everybody else came in with a whole bunch of pre-existing crap they wanted to kind of bolt into what they were doing, and that will never, ever work, I don't think.
Then for the American Revolution, there's a huge distance between the two parties at war.
Yes, we were left alone. We had a bunch of different cultures. We were geographically spread out. People were well educated, and we just really wanted to be left alone. And we tried to come up with the minimum amount of rules just to keep the thing hanging together, as opposed to all these people who've been living in these various systems over their entire life, thinking. To give you an example, we hear this all the time. What am I going to do with my project managers? Now we're moving over to Scrum. It's like, well, you're going to give them jobs. And we try to say, well, they're going to self-organize all this stuff. But there is an organizational question. We have a dozen people in a dozen roles, and you're telling me we only have 2 roles. How's that supposed to physically work? What do we physically do with each person? And we don't really have answers to that, I don't think.
To be fair, the reason that America won the revolution was because America decided they're going to sit behind rock walls and fire, while the British said we're all going to come out in bright red jackets.
Yeah, the bright red jacket thing.
We're going to stand shoulder to shoulder and let you shoot us.
Yeah, the bright red jacket, not a good look.
If the red jackets don't scare you into submission, well, then you can win that war, right?
Well, the French helped us quite a bit, too, so and it was part of that was a world war. So the first article, and this is, I think, my favorite coding article I've read all year so far, maybe in the last 6 months. This guy wrote a Minecraft server all in Bash. And it is... I would never do this.
Disturbing.
It is disturbing, isn't it? And the reason I love this isn't because this is a useful project. It's because this guy blogs And you go through his mindset and the story of how he's going through and solving all these problems of trying to get Bash to do Minecraft. And it's just really, really cool. It's what I think real problem solving is about. He's, you know, how do I handle variable length numbers? How do I do... His biggest problem, IEEE floating point. It just drove him crazy. Sound familiar? We've talked about this a couple of times. But yeah, if you're interested in how to solve problems, and I don't even know how to play Minecraft. I just thought this was freaking awesome. This guy, great, great read. My thoughts are running a Minecraft server in Bash. Like I said, but why is the first thing. And then it's like, okay, so you want to do this, how? And it's he's got some cool answers. He goes through a lot of stuff. His first problem is how to do binaries, because Bash doesn't do blobs. And everything Minecraft does is a blob. And then he goes into the variable like integers. The way they do a variable length integer is the first bit here is a signal bit. You can see the little example he's got. This is a 1 indicating there's another byte coming. So this byte needs to be joined with this second byte. And the second byte begins with a 0 indicating that's the end of the bytes. So in that way, you can create some random, it's almost like a zero linked string. You can create a random sized integer or number.
Is it kind of, are they integers? Are they like BCD, binary coded?
No, they are, hang on, I believe it's integers. He says it's LEB-128. That's a standard for compression screen, standard for integers.
Yeah.
And as he points out, the problem, one of the problems here is if you get past 127, which means you would normally have this eighth bit flipped, you get this whole other 8 bits because you can't really, you can't use that 8th bit because it's a signal bit. And so, but he had to figure out how to do, like, you know, this bit arithmetic in this scripting OS language from 1979. It's like, oh my God, wow. And he got it all working. It's a thing. It's a working system. So, yeah, he did that. This is how he actually pulls out this int to var int. It's how he pulls out a variable integer and makes it work somehow in Bash. And one of the things he did, he couldn't pipe binary into a Bash variable because Bash variables don't take binaries, of course. And so what he decided to do, he pipes it into, it's almost like a continuation, this XXD program. It just kind of hangs onto it in the pipe. And then he uses that later to send it somewhere else. He never really has to ever look at the thing. He just kind of lets the data hang out until he needs it, which is, it's wild. Wild, wild.
Wait, he needed to convert to binary or from binary?
Yes, both. Both binary and he custom data format. You remember back in the C days when you'd get this custom file format, then you have to write these custom readers for all that shit in there, and he's doing all this thing.
In Bash, you have printf, which will do that.
No. See, he's got a bit level binary format for variables inside a large blob, so he does not have a thing that printf could ever get to. He just got a bunch of ones and zeros like this, right? And so he's trying to pull out this first thing. What is it? Well, it's an int. Okay, fine. I get this next 6 bits. What's his next thing? What's a string? I get an n number to the end of the string. What's his next thing? And so there's nothing for printf to hang on to. There's no standard types for it to read and kick back out.
Yeah, but you can still do things like echo base equals 2, your variable.
You know, that's an interesting thing. You know, he could use, and he does at some point, he struggles with floating point and powers and ends up going to awk because awk has a math system that works. There's, you guys need to dive in. There's a bunch of cool stuff. He goes over how the coloring system works for each of the Bash tiles.
He's love his artwork, by the way.
It's cool stuff. Cool. I mean, this guy must really, really like Minecraft a lot. And I know I would hire this guy because this is like somebody who wants to take his own time and do neat, deep dive nerdy stuff. Very cool.
Yeah. I like the FAQ down at the bottom. Did you get down to there?
Yes.
FAQ. The most frequently asked question was why.
Why? Because I could, and it was fun.
Because I could, and it was fun. Okay, totally understand. All right. Yes.
And like I said, that's why I would hire the guy, because he has a passion for coding that transcends whatever the problems are. Okay, so the next story, and this is sort of staying with our Bash theme. This is sort of a simple, rudimentary, how to write idempotent Bash scripts. And for those of you who don't know, idempotent means you can run it over and over again and it doesn't change the system. So you run it once, maybe it makes a file. You run it again, the file's still there. Touch is a good command. That, you know, once you touch a file, it's a new file. Run touch again, it's still the same file. So it's a reentrant type of way of writing Bash. It's a good thing he did, but he just really did a bunch of commands. He really should. This works best when you do it at the script level. Had I wrote my scripts this way, which I should have, I wouldn't have had the problem I had last week, because these you can run over and over again. I got into this way of thinking with my script that I thought I had to make a test directory and then copy the test directory over to the directory I wanted to process. And that mode of thinking actually is what led down the path to deleting all my source code. If I'd wrote it idempotently, I wouldn't have had that problem. So this is
what are the command line arguments to the script that he provided?
Well, he's got commands. Touch, he's got touch, he's got...
The command line arguments.
Well, he just does commands. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I'm saying is that shouldn't he be able to write a script that you pass the script to, and it makes that script idempotent?
You just mashed up a bunch of words and sent it back to me, didn't you, Greg? Okay, you can tell me. Yeah, I know. One bullshitter to another. I know bullshit when I hear it, man. Yeah,
I should be able to write a script called idempotent.sh.
Yes.
Which you pass me the script that you want to run. Now, based on the name of your script, I am going to...
So I can't resist this joke. This guy needs to meet up with the Minecraft guy, because those two guys together... Yeah, you can do system D, the Docker thing. There's ways of isolating code such as this idempotent.
I'm just thinking about.
No, you don't want to watch. You don't want to write. You don't want to write shell check over again in Bash to make it idempotent. That's ridiculous. One of the reasons you don't want to do that is you can't determine side effects for whatever commands on the system, which could be any of like 1,000 different Bash commands. You can isolate the process, snapshot, run it, and then roll it back. That's perfectly fine. Systemd does that. Docker does that. It's a doable thing to make it idempotent in that way. But you can't go through and evaluate. It's the halting problem. There's all these bunch of problems in trying to write a script to process scripts. Not impossible, but it's not something you want to do. Sorry, Greg. I didn't mean to cut you off like that. It sounded good. I liked the way it sounded. That was really good, but no.
Yeah, I don't get idempotent. What the heck is it?
Well, idempotent is like a pure function, or it just means that I run this function, it does this thing. And the thing, it never does anything different than this thing, and I can run it a second time, and I get the same thing. So a random number function would never be idempotent. Something that appends a file may or may not be. He's got examples of how to make that work.
Depending on the file changed.
Right. So, yeah, he would just do seek the files. He's got that example. He's got the file change. Where's the touch is one.
There's also strong idempotent versus weak idempotent.
I'm going to continue on. He's got grenade. All right, back. He's got make dir. Making a directory is something you don't want to crash, and once you do it, it's there. He's got symbolic links and removing a file, modifying a file. Sometimes you're adding a new line to an existing file, James's question, and you need to make sure you don't add a second time.
The difference in strong idempotent versus weak idempotent is whether or not I can ever see a partial change.
Yeah, it's this...
Isn't a partial interchange?
Yeah. So let's imagine that I was putting through 5 things as a transaction.
Yes.
Okay. Is it ever possible that you could view 3 out of those 5 things as opposed to all 5?
Okay, we're covering this. This actually, if we had to pick a topic today, it would be idempotent, transactional-based versus string-based. This is what we're talking about. This guy just does the commands, but as Greg points out, once you start joining commands into scripts, that's when it starts getting interesting. Do you want to see the pieces in between? Is the whole script a transaction or a pipeable thing itself? These are design questions you need to make as a script programmer.
A good way to think about it is, let's say I have Operation A, Operation B, and Operation C, which are all independent of each other. Now, basic item potency is going to be, if we talk about Operation A, I've gone and written it, but we have no idea whether or not that thing has actually been written, and I have my connection cut off. So, I am going to retry.
And you want to have the same effect that you did the first time, because you don't know how many times you may have run it.
Correct. And this is the normal case. Where it starts getting more fun is that we actually had a group of joined operations.
Yes, transactions.
Because doing item potency in a single operation is basically, okay, we'll treat it as a message. Message has an ID. If I've seen that ID before, and I believe that I have processed it, then I will not process it.
It's also called memoization.
But what happens when there are three? And I believe I have processed two of them. And we might have had a failover circumstance which has happened. And we might have somebody else who believes they have processed one of them.
This is probably, I said, this is probably one of the deepest topics we've got into a Nerd Ramp so far, because if you're thinking in a transactional sense and you've got separate pieces, like Greg's talking about with the probably event store, CQRS, then you have to go through and figure out what you're going to do if you've got piece 1, 3, and 8 of an 8-part thing. You hang on to the other 3 and 8 till 2 gets here, and you have errors in each of those. It gets quite interesting.
Well, you can even run into this inside of a single transaction when you're at a lower level. So what happens if we ran into a software bug where we had to invalidate a block on disk?
Yeah, you asked.
Yes,
yeah.
We know that we said that this happened, but now we've realized that it didn't. Sorry.
I think the industry as a whole is really coming to terms with this as we scale out to the cloud, because, you know, Greg, you've been in this space for some time, and I think some functional cloud guys have been here, but there are a lot of newbies here, and you're used to doing this old C#, you know, begin transaction, throw some stuff at the database, end transaction, it's done, and no, world ain't like that necessarily no more, and you've got to think through things like you're talking about.
Well, and to be honest, item potency is going to be better in almost every circumstance.
Right, because
not every, but almost every. It has its own complexities associated.
Oh my God! And this has to do with that. We talked about the conflict-free replicated data types a week or two ago. This is also related to those as well. If you were only using the CDRTs, CRDTs, then they are by definition omnipotent, because they're reversible and they can arrive in any order. Cool stuff. Then let's go to the next one, because I think there's two or three other articles that are right down this pipeline. The next article is the factorial mindset. If you guys have been following along on Discord with me for the last 2 weeks, my wife has been sick and I've been playing Hunka Hunka Factorio. It's a programmer crack. And I described it today as Factorio is iterative system architecture design using composable functions with changing business conditions. And that really is what it is, but it's much more fun than that sounds. And so this guy actually talks about how he thought Factorio was a stupid game. He started playing it and he realized, no, this is actually one of the few games that are helpful for coders to learn how to play. And I agree with him completely. Fun stuff. It forces you to externalize the way you think about architectures of systems. And that's and not do that in like UML diagrams, do that in a working model that has things moving around. which is a different type of thing entirely. Good stuff. So, Greg, this next one, goes out to Greg Young. James, have you heard of something called the robustness principle?
Not until today.
Okay, this is an old idea from the days back when they wrote all the stuff that we run in Bash. And the idea is you take about...
Are you talking about when Martin Fowler still had a brown beard?
Yes, back when Ivar Jacobson actually had one like a normal colored hair. It's basically, think of like a unit command LS.
I can kind of see what it is, from reading about it. I hadn't heard the name before.
Yes. Michael Feather says this is the old don't fail. Just run. Whatever happens, run. He said, and everybody stopped. Well, that sort of points out the thing itself, doesn't it? Okay, what did you say, James?
Oh, just when I was reading through this, I was thinking this sounds like what HTML does, because you can have mistakes all over the place, and you'll still get something on your screen, maybe.
Exactly. This comes from the old piping command thing, like we saw with Bash days, because if you throw something at a pipe, it may not be able to process it, but it doesn't crash your OS. I mean, so it'll take damn near anything you send to it, but it just won't do stuff that it needs to do unless it has what it needs. And that was the original philosophy, God, for decades. That's why we can still use this Bash stuff, because it doesn't matter what you send to it. Well, they started using that with HTML. And the thing is that protocols are not functions. If you have a protocol, you're basically doing a transactional thing. Give me this web page based on this URI I'm sending. I will give it to you or not. Yes, no, boom, boom. And that data arrives in a bunch of hunks like Greg was talking about, boom, boom. And they tried to use this send me anything type methodology for HTML. And the protocols, that type of thinking is a piping type of thinking, not a transaction type of thinking. It's not going to hold up at scale. And that's kind of what they're running into here. Yeah, you're not going to go like, go to this web page and whatever comes back, send it to this other script and over there, whatever, because bringing up the web page itself is the event. And either happens yes or no. And inside of that, maybe like you said, the tags might take damn near anything, but the transaction, the protocol itself has to tell you what's wrong.
Your schema is changing, and your schema is possibly changing.
Yes. It's just not going to scale. Not for the kind of worldwide protocols we're doing. It works in markup, it works in pure functions, works in stuff Greg and I were talking about, idempotent stuff, but it does not work in protocols, because protocols by definition are wide open and are supposed to tell you useful things about when they don't work. In other words, the error message is almost as important as the damn thing doing it.
To be fair, the majority of a protocol specification tells you what you cannot do.
Martin.
Outside of everything you're allowed to do, right?
Yeah,
If you go read a protocol specification, the vast majority of the protocol specification is not talking about what you can do. It's talking about what you cannot do and what happens when you do that.
Right, because if I'm writing a web browser, I'm sending some bunch of chunks to a web server using a protocol, and I'm expecting either nothing to happen, like goodness, or any one of dozens or hundreds of different messages. Even the goodness should send me messages, but I'm expecting sort of a transactional conversation, not for just to go away. This is not an idempotent, it's just not that type of activity. Yeah, it's a good thing. I'm glad that they're doing this, but I wish they would kind of realize why they're having the problem, but I get it. So this next number, essay, a nice essay here. Imaginary numbers are reality. You guys like math? Good to read. He goes through how imaginary numbers have been discovered. Basically, the way it looks, I think the word imaginary was a bad label. Basically, life comes to us in tuples or maybe eight poles or something, and we just ignore everything but like the last thing, and we just use that for counting and such. But really, the universe is set up in a set of pairs or octurnians or whatever. Cool stuff.
Well, there is a subset of those which are known as irrational numbers. I mean, how would you explain I to somebody without saying that it's imaginary?
The
square root of minus one.
Yes,
so you can't imagine two numbers you multiply together to give you minus one.
Yes, but it must be imaginary.
Well, yeah, but then everything's imaginary. It's imaginary shapes. It was a bad label. If you're interested, Greg, you can read the article, and the guy actually goes over three examples where they had to do something. And eventually they just called it imaginary, and this was several hundred years after they started using it because carrying around square root of negative one everywhere, it's just got kind of old, I guess. Cool examples. Going back, I think, almost to early B.C. time. No, the Hagia Sophia, the guy who designed the Hagia Sophia, actually was stuck with a problem. He would have to use the square root of negative numbers. And what he did was just throw away the negative sign and kept going. It kind of worked out fine for him. But it didn't continue to work out. Yeah, cool stuff.
But we are just now running into the difference between engineers and mathematicians.
With the Hagia Sophia, or like today in the show?
Engineers, we have to make things work. Mathematicians, yes. They're like, we can come up with a nice idea for this.
Yes. Programming is a polite philosophy. By that I mean there's a lot of bullshitting at the beginning, there's a conversation in the middle, and at the end we put together kind of semi-formal systems that have to work kind of half-assed. And so that's philosophy. It's like, hey, it kind of works. We're done. We move on. Math is not like math. You start with symbols that rigidly must work with one another, and then they worry about reality at some point in the future. And we don't do that. We are basically bullshitters at heart. I think a good programmer is obsessive, like this Bash guy, and they're also really...
Speak for yourself, Dan.
Yes. Okay, I'm really a bullshitter. Hey, I'll take that one, both. So, speaking of programmers really screwing up, this amazes me that we have not talked about this. The United Kingdom had a post office scandal. This went on for almost 15 years. The post office in the United Kingdom bought some software, I think, from Fujitsu, and the software was unable to add up the cash registers at the post office every day consistently. And so when they didn't add up, they charged these people with crimes. Like thousands of people were dismissed. They were reprimanded. This one guy went to jail for 3 years. This is not like programmers gone wild. This is like, oh my God, what the hell did Fujitsu do here? And so they're looking into it. They think it's probably the biggest malpractice suit. More than 700 sub-postmasters.
No. This is not how you deal with it. The way you deal with it is you find that project manager. Given that it's the UK, you take them and you publicly flog them.
Oh, yeah. Well, can't you see, like, some help desk, like, in the Philippines or some third India or whatever, you know? Hello, this is George. Hey, George, this thing's not adding up. I will... Thank you for calling. You're pre-canned. I'm really happy to get your message today. And it's like, I'm going to jail. George, help me. We've put this on a ticket. And you're just like, you get the little call back. Did you feel like you had a good service from George today? Like, press one for yes. Press two, press four if you're already in jail.
I'm wondering if this was... Oh, go ahead.
The people were prosecuted because they were being accused of theft?
Yes.
Even though it was the software's problem?
That's exactly right. It's addition, subtraction, too. It's not as if it were some sort of... It's just simple adding and subtracting. Yeah, this is... That's just... This one guy went to jail for over 3 years. It was his first day on the cash register. His supervisor stood beside him the entire day and watched everything he did. And the software said, hey, he stole some money. And so that guy went to jail. And he was like, but, and nope, sorry, you're out of here. Yeah. We you know, Bob. Yeah, Bob talks about ethical programming, and here we go. We have left the point where programming's just saying, we're going to do like a guess the number or hangman game. And we're at the point now where we're killing people and sending them to jail and everything. And as an industry, we need to I laugh because you can't, crying or getting angry is not helpful. This is an awful thing.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, should there be liability associated to that scrum master?
Yeah, I know. The programmers. And it couldn't be just one program. It had to be every program that looked at a ticket that said it was, because you got to know people called in tickets and said it was broken. And management.
Well, you know, the lawyers are coming.
But that ticket may not have been prioritized.
Well, that would be the three amigos, I think, are responsible for prioritizing tickets ahead of the scrum.
Three amigos.
Yeah. Yeah, I know I can sing all these songs, but the problem is that somehow people went to jail, and that's messed up. That's really, really messed up. And so we're seeing people stick software between citizens and the law, and that's always going to be a really bad idea. Whether it's traffic cams, license plate readers, you know, metadata monitor, it's just never, ever going to be a good thing.
I was going to say, software between people and the law. Have you ever heard of this thing called Google?
Hmm. Yeah. We're going to have to, and I'm not.
It seems like a report from a terminal, which should not be enough evidence to convict somebody.
Yes, this is
stealing. You'd think there'd need to be some other evidence or something that, but you, in your UK, it's maybe different than it is here, right? We've got innocent until proven guilty. Do they have that? Or are they guilty until you prove yourself innocent?
I believe.
It might be the opposite.
No, they're innocent until proven guilty. But yeah, I think that the thing is, what weight do judges and courts give the software? It's because I think what's happening is they're just saying, hey, software says you did this wrong. Boom, you did it wrong. And that's, wow, that's really bad.
Well, that would be, I would suspect that.
And I don't know.
I know what software is.
Yeah, but see, most people think the computer said X, so, you know, it must be true. Yes. Yeah. That's.
There is one significant difference between the UK, or should I say, in particular, England. I'm not sure if it applies to all of it, and the US in terms of the justice system.
The wicks.
Exactly.
Say it again.
Got it. Bam. The other one.
Guaranteed. The judge won't have hair.
You know, they have this thing about whether you're a witch or not, too. If you weigh as much as a duck, you must be weighed of wood, in which case you must be a witch. Yeah, this is, comes down to us from ages past. It must be true. If the computer says you're a duck, you must be made of wood. Yeah, it's a bad situation.
No. This is going to be very funny as we look in the future, as we start trying to make artificial intelligence will decide cases. So in the UK, we're going to end up with a laptop that has a wig on top of it.
Like I said, you have to laugh. So I read this article, this post yesterday on Hacker News.
It could be a virtual judge, you know, like where the virtual image of the judge on the laptop screen has the wig.
Yes.
I want it to be a laptop with a wig on top of it.
Well, think Max Headroom with a wig.
Yes, that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
Speaking of AI and justice, this guy I read yesterday in Hacker News, he had he doesn't do anything wrong, he's not a spammer. He got a spammer email, some kind of stupid thing, and the guy had did the CC list of like 50 people. And so he said, you know, I'm going to have some fun. So he replies all and says, you know, you're a spammer. Stop bugging us all. Well, because he replied all to the spam email, Google shuts down his email account of 20 years. And that shuts him out of every kind of fucking every service he has, because Google shut him down. And there's nobody to talk to. The algorithm has decided he's bad. And now he has no financial... It's completely destroyed his life. Yeah. So yeah, we're in the you got to laugh territory because that's some serious stuff. British tax authorities made their first seizure of NFTs. That's a non-fungible transaction. These are funny to begin with because NFTs are basically little animated GIFs of a dancing clown horse.
I'm sorry, I'm a bit stupid, but it being they're non-fungible, how did they seize them?
I guess they funged them. They reverse non-funged. The special computer with the wig takes the non out. Yeah, so I read this, and basically these are crypto art pieces. And people were using crypto art to do things they do with normal art, which is launder money and all that stuff. So they came in and stole these cryptographically secure dancing clown pictures that they say are worth millions of dollars. And I guess we'll kind of reach this dope on the table part where these guys will show up at this press conference and it'll be like little pictures of different little gifts. And now we seized all of these pictures today and a massive crackdown. I don't know I don't know how you prosecute somebody who has like a little bunch of crypto that he didn't tell you about. Like Greg said, how do you know what's in there? If he didn't tell you, you can't see it. So they say it's worth almost $2 million worth of little animated gifts and such. It's, I've got a lot of pictures on my computer. I don't think any are worth $2 million, but I'm willing to sell some. It just amazes me. This next I understand cryptographic currency. I understand NFTs. Basically, if I can lock up a thing, it doesn't matter what the thing is, if I can lock it up, that means I've created scarcity, and we can trade it like stamps. It's just a tradable thing. But how do you ever know whether or not there's something? It's supposed to be just for you to know. Nobody else can know. So, by definition, secure.
To be fungible, we are saying that there is something specific which is being defined.
A generic, yes. There is a generic that is being defined that this is an instance of, and that it is tradable with other generics of that type, yes.
Correct. So, if I'm trading something that's non-fungible, how do you seize?
Right, the whole thing, the reason it's non-fungible is twofold. First of all, you don't really know what's in that little cryptographic box, and secondly, only the guy with the key can get to it. And so both of those things make it, by definition, non-fungible. And unless you got the key, you can't seize it.
Can't the key be copied? Can't the non-fungible be copied?
Yeah, it can be copied, but it's a two-parter. It's the key to the thing and your key. And when you sell it, you do a cryptographic transaction between. So it becomes so that your private key actually unlocks its key. And yeah, if they can steal this guy's identity, they can unlock it. But even then, how do you know it's worth $2 million? It's just a little picture of a horse or whatever. You can say anything.
A picture of a horse?
Well, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. It can be.
Come on, Dan. What is this picture of?
Well, they've done a lot of cartoons, as I understand it. And there have been a lot of art stolen off of internet websites and turned into NFTs. And why couldn't you go to the website and get the picture on your own? Well, because, like I said, it doesn't really matter what's in the little cryptographic box. What matters is I own it, and it becomes scarce. And until I sell it to you, you can't have it.
Let's be very clear here. When we talk about something that's non-fungible, something that is non-fungible is something which is unique.
Yes. Yep.
There is nothing else like it. And, yes. And we can talk about this, whether it's modern things like something that's been built upon a blockchain.
Yep.
Or we can talk about this like, you know that show where they got the old bald guy that deals with all the antiques?
Yep.
Very often he's dealing with non-fungibles.
Yes. That's a physical non-fungible.
Yes. There's one of these things that exists in the world. Yes. So what is the value of it?
So yeah, when I encryptograph this picture of a horse I stole from the internet, I lock it in the box, and then I cryptographically transfer it to James such that I can't see it anymore, and nobody else in the world can see that, and he's the only person that owns that. That makes it non-fungible. You could steal the file, and you just got a big hunk of cryptographic stuff that it's nothing. But unless he gives you the key.
There are terrible things to be doing with pictures of your dirty socks.
That's not a bad idea, yeah.
Yeah. You'd be surprised when they open them up.
Yeah, and the crazy thing is it doesn't really matter. And they're selling for millions of dollars, and if you ask me, the reason they're selling is that all the cryptocurrency bros are trying to hype the market up so they can dump the pictures of their little dancing babies and make a bunch. It's a hype cycle right now. But if there's something, cryptocurrencies like stamp collection, if you want to give me the money, it's worth something. This is Paul Graham. Yeah, this is Paul Graham. He tweeted a few days back. Paul Graham is, a billionaire by now, founder of ViaWeb, founder of Y Combinator. Was responsible for running a company that picked successful startups. So he ran one, picked a bunch. He made all this money by picking companies that did well. And he said, I've never read a business plan or balance sheet. And he said he could take 10 minutes and talk to the founders and determine whether or not the founders were worthy investing in or not, and that was worth more than just reading a bunch of stuff they put on, kind of fluff on a piece of paper somewhere. Interesting.
I would agree with him 100%.
I do too, and I think that when we look at MBA programs, that they focus so much on the details of this kind of shit, and it's not anything near what's necessary to actually make a successful business.
I think it's actually the opposite. So I've gone through a lot of this, and what I've learned in terms of reading books is not how to figure out if something will succeed. It's that if something is an imminent failure.
That's one of the reasons they say that it's difficult in your 30s and 40s to do a really high-risk startup, because you get so good at figuring out all the reasons it won't work, you refuse to try things. Okay, so this next article is really, really cool. This is an electromagnetic rifle. Oh my God, I got to get me one of these guys. Okay, so basically it's a rail gun. So it's got magnets, it's got capacitors, it's got this little tiny thing it shoots, and every 3 seconds you can fire this magnetic dart, basically. There's a video to watch, I haven't watched it yet, but this is awesome. I don't know why you wouldn't want one of these.
There's one major worry. You see that cable coming out of it?
Yeah.
That cable would be likely plugged into a backpack.
I was kind of concerned about that too. Exactly what sort of power supply you would need. This looks like a Gen 1 type thing because it's every 3 seconds and it's a muzzle velocity 250 feet per second. But even then, the guy points out, at that slow muzzle velocity with a very sharp object, that's a dangerous thing. It's a very, very dangerous weapon.
That's basically a bow and arrow.
Yeah, it is. I would not want to be on the other end of that thing. And it just this looks so cool. This is like Terminator stuff. This is awesome.
Future of railgun. Yeah. Railguns.
Yeah, you can just see like Arnold knocking at Sarah Connor. Yes. Do you have a battery?
Yeah, if you plug in his hand on your screen.
Yes.
And you can see the smaller one there. At 250 feet per second, if you were wearing a winter coat, it would bounce off you.
If it were sharp, it not. But yeah, and it's like probably 50 yards, I would say, and you would want a very sharp projectile. Yeah, it's not. You can't go past 50 yards or so.
Why am I not just throwing knives at this point? Why am I using a railgun?
Hello, hello, come on, hello, yeah, because that's the fact, right?
That's completely fair.
Yeah, shoot a couple times with this thing and then stab him because Yeah, I thought.
Put your eye out with it. What's the muzzle velocity of a BB?
It's close. I believe these two are.
No, it's actually more than 250. if you get a reasonably powered air rifle, you're sitting at about 350.
Oh, man.
And I'm going to have to verify this now.
Yeah, this is something.
Yeah, 200 feet a second.
For a BB gun?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So this is faster than a BB. This is faster than a speeding BB.
No. So we can hit a 22 caliber air rifle, such as the Benjamin Discovery or Marauder, and it'll put a 14.3 grain pellet with a muzzle velocity of 900 feet per second.
Yeah, that's a pellet gun. You're talking about a pump pellet gun. A pump pellet gun is a different thing entirely than a CO2 powered BB gun. So, yeah, I used to have a pump pellet gun, and that's almost a 22. It's a dangerous thing.
I've got a really strong pellet gun. I think muzzle velocity is up there. It's pretty fast and pretty accurate.
Guys, I'm just curious. I might be at a certain age. Mm-hmm. When you guys were younger, did you shoot each other with BB guns?
The funny thing is, my cousins actually did shoot me. Yes, I was shot. I didn't shoot anybody else, but yeah.
A friend of mine was shot in the ear. With a gun that was supposedly unloaded, and then we also hit a Sheridan, and you could pump that up 10 times. You didn't want to be shot with that would really hurt.
Oh, so like we used to play BB gun wars.
Oh my God, with that, you have goggles?
Yes, of course.
Oh yeah. Oh wow. Yeah, you could do that. Yeah, it's kind of like paintball.
It's kind of an out course of that.
I remember being at my grandmother's house.
I guess the BBs actually hurt.
Oh, I was at my grandmother's house. We were in her kitchen, and my cousin walks in. And I said, "What do you have there?" And he pulls up the rifle, shoots me right in the cheek, and says, "A BB gun." And I'm like, "Ah!" And I cried quite a bit after that.
My friend got a BB right in your lobe, and it was 3 stitches to put it back in.
Oh, yeah.
It was a point blank shot.
For Christmas, I got a Red Ryder rifle with the compass in the stock. No shit. That's what I got for Christmas this year. It's up on the shelf. Very nice. And I don't know why. My daughter saw it at the store. She's like, "Dad has to have this." And so that's so I got one.
So how long do we have until you're without an eye?
No, it's you got to watch out for icicles. Icicles are very dangerous this time of year. Fall right off, put your eye right out. True story. Yeah. Where did James go? Do you know?
Well, I would not know anything more than you know.
Yeah,
I've only heard the same thing that you've
heard. I thought maybe I was gabbing and he just missed what he said. Yeah, I should go get the... If James comes back... There we go. Okay. All right, hang on. I'll be back in a second, guys. You got to see this.
You know what this is? Greg, you know what this weapon is?
No, I do not know that one.
This is the bug assault weapon. Here's the ammo.
Yep.
Table salt. And you can...
Nice. I got it.
It's a great thing to have around, especially in Florida.
It's the salt shotgun for the fly.
Exactly. You got to be pretty close to it, but it works really nicely. Oh, you got the Red Ryder. Dan, have you seen this?
Oh, wow. What we got there, James?
This is the Bug Assault.
Oh, whoa.
It's a shotgun.
Oh, cool.
Salt, there's the ammo. You cock it, and you shoot. And the damn flies are dead.
This is my Red Ryder. Yeah. It's got the thing that tells time. And, it's actually a sundial. The kid says it's the thing that tells time, and it's like a little sundial. I guess he didn't know what that was. And
so you can get home on time.
Yeah, I guess some of the sundial. So, yeah, fair enough.
North is.
But... Well, you'd have to hold it. You have to be level too. The next story This is just a follow-up from what we did before. The Navy released some more stuff. If you're following this UAP, which is UFO story, you can dive down on this. Basically, they got the deck logs, and it's not just somebody saw the planet Venus. It's a very interesting story. I don't know what the hell it is, but that's why it's interesting. So the final article, a security guard on his first day at work doodles eyes into a $1 million painting. And that was also his last day at work. I don't know what to say about that. I guess it seemed like a good idea. It was a painting of people without eyes, which was worth $1 million. You know, well, hey, this painting needs some eyes to it. So he drew some eyes in and ruined the painting. But you shouldn't doodle on the art. If you're a security guard at the art museum, you really should not doodle on top of art. Bad idea. Bad. Here's the... I can't believe this.
Yeah, I think that would definitely be a career-limiting move.
Yeah, it had to be.
Let me throw up a alternative scenario. What if he was not just some random guy, but he is actually Banksy, and he did that?
Who?
Banksy.
Who's that?
Artist. Like he's sort of like what's his face? I can't think of that guy's name.
Well, is it his painting?
No, but Banksy's more famous than whoever drew that painting.
Well, this is
Banksy came and did it. Although he'd be like graffitiing over the painting that somebody else made, that painting would be worth more afterwards.
And if the security guard took a picture of the painting and made an NFT out of it, then he could be a millionaire now from the...
Exactly.
Okay, so what have you guys been consuming over the past week, James? Movies, TV, anything cool?
Oh, I picked up Hail Mary.
Oh, yeah,
I've been reading that. I mean, not this one.
Yeah.
That's part of the deal anyway, too, but... the book.
Excellent book.
Pretty good.
Yes.
I think they're making it sound a little too easy to figure out how to talk to aliens.
Yes.
But,
While you may feel this way, have you tested it?
Do you know any real aliens that you're trying?
I have no way of testing it. Yeah. Although, we have not been able to communicate very effectively with dolphins yet.
Nah.
And they... talk with sound, so...
The movie Arrival.
That's not what I would test.
Watch the movie Arrival. Best movie I've seen as far as communicating. Or aliens show up and they try to figure out the language. It actually is realistic. I agree that this guy... I like the book a lot. I think it's not the best book in the entire universe. Some people overstate. The guy seems to kind of go back to his old set up a science puzzle, solve a science puzzle over and over again. And that's one of the first, like, six or seven times, and it gets kind of old. Because you see him setting it up, and then you see him doing it. It's like, okay.
I really liked The Martian when I read that one. Same author.
Yes, and that was the same That was the same thing.
The engineer.
Yes. Pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
Greg, how about you?
I am mostly waiting on a book to come in. And I'm going to send it to you. What the hell? Why does that not work? Oh my god. It's Vladimir Putin, life coach.
It's the name of the book?
Oh, I've heard of this.
Put it into Google.
I've got a text. Scott Ambler. It's only the second time he said, hey, where are you guys at? Yeah, I saw this. It was like
my gosh. It's a real thing.
It's absolutely real. And I am just waiting to receive it. So it's just going to be hilarious, and you know it.
Yeah, how to take over Crimea. Is that the answer?
probably not. It was released in November 2018.
Well, wait, when was Crimea taken?
2019, 2020. No, it was been a couple of years, and not been 2018 though. Since then.
I don't think it was during Trump. I think it was during Obama.
You mean Biden? Yeah, Trump went out on 2020.
Oh, highly rated. In case you've got.
I am more just waiting to see what they actually say in the book.
Did you buy a used one or a new one?
Are you kidding me?
So, do you guys? What do you think about Ukraine? You think
Kindle?
Do you think? Okay. Do you think Russia's going into Ukraine? Yes or no? Nope, don't know. Yeah.
I don't know. I hear a lot of opinion both directions.
Greg, you going to place a bet? I mean, figuratively speaking.
No, I will not place a bet. Because this is something I feel very strongly
about. Yeah, I do too. It's a very bad thing. I'm thinking a 60% chance he does not go in. I think the game he's playing is to keep all his options open and run up to the wire as close as he can get to going in, keeping open to go both ways. I believe that's, and he's almost as likely to go in as not, but I think because he hasn't called up his reserves, a couple other sort of technical things, I think no, but it's by far a sure deal. Could go the other way, and that's a very, very bad thing. I have,
most likely.
Yeah.
Do you think it's most likely he will?
No, most likely he will never invade.
Yeah, he's seen what kind of mileage you can get.
I heard there'd be a really bad, long, drawn-out affair long-drawn-out war.
Yeah, I think if he does go in, it's a limited thing. Maybe he takes Svezenpor, the port there or something. I can't see him. He's getting so much press, so much attention. His economy's tanked. His people are kind of, you know, angry. This is par for the course.
No, he's got 100 bulk barrel oil now, so he's loading up his retirement accounts.
Yeah, as long as he's got they got rid of Arkel. He's given us a master class in decision-centric warfare, which is I keep all my options open. I make all the money off the crisis, and then really it's kind of anticlimactic after that. So. I finished up a book called The Power of the Dog, which is a crime fiction novel, which is fun. I wanted something different, and I started in on the Great Courses series on, what the hell was it? Great Courses series of books that have made history and can change your life. Excellent, super cool series. I've got, I think, about 36 half-hour lectures. Each one's a different book, and the guy just tells you why it's cool, why you should read it. I love these survey courses. Lots of fun.
Yeah, I did the one on most important inventions or whatever.
Ooh, well, I haven't done that one.
That was pretty cool. You know, it goes way back to the wheel or the inclined plane or something.
This guy's
in each era, right, where the different invention made some important change that actually made a huge change on society.
Was it a good speaker? Was it the professor?
He wasn't bad. I remember like a good, you know, it's kind of, those speakers can be kind of dry, but it was driving Mary Lee, my wife, crazy. When I listen to it, it's like, how can you listen to it? It's like, well, I'm interested in what he has to say. It's like, yeah, but listen to how he talks.
The reason I got this one was I finished another series with the same professor. He's the best professor. I've got probably 80 of these series, and he's the best one. It's Rufus Fears. He's won like a bazillion awards, and I loved him so much in the last series. I bought this one, and he's just got a wonderful speaking voice. It's almost like a, reminds me of almost like a Protestant minister. He's very well spoken. Good stuff.
So with books that you can deal with many people on, was Dale Carnegie listed?
No. We'll go back. We've got Beowulf. We've got these are powerful, world-changing books of the centuries. This Dale Carnegie's just not even 100 years old yet. He did Solzhenitsyn, the Gulag Archipelago. That's from, I think, 62 or so.
Solzhenitsyn?
Yes, yes. He doesn't do it in time order. He just, he's got a theme over what these books taught him and why he thought they were important, and he pulls out things from the theme. He starts off with a Lutheran minister that was imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp that wrote this excellent book on why it's important to stick to your standards. He does Socrates. He's all the big stories he's got covered.
Oh my God. I just pulled this up on Google. This is fucking terrible.
Yeah, they did get killed Socrates.
Do you know who they listed as the second one? Malcolm Gladwell.
The second, who are you talking, what are you talking about?
Oh, no, this was the life-changing books.
No.
Number two is Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell.
No, that's not, no. Yeah, but, yeah, you're doing bad internet, my friend. You need to put the body condom on, because you're going some dark places. Like, you ever go to Reddit and they ask a question like, what's the top 10 movies? And it's all like bullshit from the last 10 years. It's like, holy cow, guys. There's like been 80 years of movies. It can't be the last 10 years.
Oh, Greg, I hope that Google's not going to be inundating me with ads for this Vladimir Putin studio.
Damn. Oh, I will send you a link just to make sure that you get it.
You remember those pictures of Putin, like bareback, riding the horse around and wrestling a bear? Do you guys remember? Yeah. They had a heyday with Putin memes. Okay, so let me do my adios thing, guys. Let's see, how do I do this? Push this button. Hey there, you've wasted yet another hour or so with the Nerds on Nerd Roundup today. We're really happy you dropped by. We're here every week. We cover tech news from a programmer standpoint. We try to have as much fun as possible. I'm at DanielBMarkham.com. I am Daniel B. Markham, and I will see you on the internet.